Today on the John Ankerberg Show, many people are aware of the different Islamic groups in the world, from those marching across Africa and across Iraq and Syria, to those in Iran and Saudi Arabia, Egypt and Turkey, to those living in Europe and here in America. People wonder, where do these Islamic groups get their basic ideas? What are their goals? When they quote the Quran and Hadith and say they are following what Muhammad taught, is this true? What does history tell us about Muhammad? How did he live? What kind of example did he lead? What did he teach? And what laws did he establish? Is Islam really a religion of peace? After Muhammad died, how did Muslims follow his teachings for the next 1,000 years? Today, three special guests will tell us. First, Kamal Saleem, who was born in Lebanon and was recruited by the Muslim Brotherhood. He worked with Yasser Arafat and the PLO, trained international terrorists in Libya, and fought with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. Later, the Muslim Brotherhood sent him to the United States to infiltrate our society and recruit Americans to be members of terror organizations here. Through extraordinary circumstances, he became a Christian. Second is Dr. Emir Kaner, a former Sunni Muslim who grew up in America, where his father built mosques. When he decided to leave Islam and become a Christian, his family disowned him. He went on to earn his PhD in history from the University of Texas at Arlington and is now president of Truett McConnell College in Georgia. And my third guest is the former commander of Delta Force, who later became commanding general of all U.S. Special Army Forces around the world. He is retired three-star general William G. Boykin, who has also served at the CIA in Special Operations, and for 4 years was Deputy Undersecretary of Defense. He is now the Senior Vice President at the Family Research Council. Join us for this special edition of the John Ankerberg Show. Welcome to our program. We've got a great one for you today. We've got three special guests that you've already heard. We've got General Boykin, we've got Kamal Saleem, we've got Dr. Emir Kaner. We got two fellows that came out of Sunni Muslim background. One that grew up in the United States, his father built mosques, and when he became a Christian, his family disowned him. Didn't kill him, but disowned him. And the other one grew up in Lebanon, learned about jihad when he was 7 years of age, was involved with the PLO, with also the Muslim Brotherhood, and after a lot of conflict, was sent to this country to infiltrate our society and worked with the Muslim Brotherhood here in our country. And we're going to talk about that up ahead, but the Lord changed his life and in a wonderful way. And so we're talking about what is happening. I mean, Islam is just in the news all over the place every day. And people are having questions. What is going on? What is happening? What is this thing that we call Sharia? Because we see country after country embracing Sharia. You all know that we've got the OIC at the United Nations. You got 57 countries that have banded together, and they are trying to outlaw anybody that would even criticize Islam in the world and do it with punishments. Can you imagine? We're going to talk about all of this today, and Emir, I'd like you to start us off. What is Sharia? Give us a definition. Where does it come from? What are the Pew polls telling us about how people in the world view Sharia?
The viewer has to understand that Sharia comes from two things. One is the precepts of the Quran, and secondly is the example of Muhammad. When you blend those two together, you get what is the constitution of Islam. Sharia comes from the Quran itself, Surah 45 and verse 18, that clear path that each person is to follow. So it deals with you, Islam being a cradle to grave religion, 24/7. It deals with how you dress, when you go to war, who you're going to marry, how you do finances. It is your jurisprudence. It is your constitution. It is so important to the listener to understand this, because when the rise of communism came in the 19th century, they had to understand Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels and Das Kapital. It is crucial that the person listening understand what Sharia law is, that they read it for themselves, especially through the most authenticated sources, which is Al-Bukhari and Muslim, the two most authenticated sources, to recognize all of these Muslims moving in to officialize this political Islam, what that means to Muslims, non-Muslims, to those who want to follow Islam strictly, to those who are going to be subjugated and persecuted because it now becomes the official path.
Let me ask a follow-up on that, and that is, why is it that it would be against the Constitution of the United States to have people here in America practicing Sharia?
Yeah, I remember in 2006 when a Democratic congressman took his oath of office on the Quran. Keith Ellison, Democrat from Minnesota, and it was strong and stark, not simply because I was a Christian when you usually take it on the Bible, more so because you put it on the Quran. You can't uphold the Constitution and hold to a literal Quran. Just take Article 1 with the freedom of speech, assembly, press, and religion, where you do not have that according to the Hadith. If you say anything against Muhammad, you can be fined, imprisoned, and killed. That is part of Sharia. There is cruel, unusual punishment in Sharia law. That takes away Article 8. The way they treat women is against Article 14. So you start listing the problematic sources that you can't have the United States Constitution or Sharia. One will win over the other, and we are in a political battle for our soul.
Let's follow up on that, too. And Kamal, you know all about Sharia. You've lived under Sharia. You wanted to bring Sharia here to America. You tried to do that, all
yes.
right? And you've seen it in fact. One of the things that struck me about what Emir was just saying is that when this is given to you, when you accept this, it's given to you in stone. You don't have choices after that. This is the way it's going to be done. Why is this a threat to Western society all around?
Well, we got to understand that the indoctrination, when it starts with us, it starts at young age. I learned right there on the same table that I ate on, right there where I was eating. That's where I was learning what to do and what not to do. So therefore, we were subjugated. We were, you know, roped, we were yoked with Sharia from our childhood. But that's for us. But in order to live that Sharia, we must subjugate our enemy to Sharia. So therefore, what happened is there are stages of Sharia when it's imparted to different nation by percentage. When a Muslim are weak, when a Muslim are in good standing, when a Muslim in power.
Explain that. What does that mean?
It means when you are 1% and lesser
of the population.
Of a population, mm-hmm. What happened then? You are peaceful. And over there, the Sharia law that you practice is the hidden Sharia, which is you practice it yourself, and now you affect the sphere of influence that you have, your neighborhood, and whatsoever. When it accelerates a little bit to 2%, now you start going to the jail system, poor neighborhood, universities, and whatsoever, and start affecting the government itself and subjugate it to Sharia by lobbying. And when it accelerates to new level, it starts demonstrating into the street and put pressure by intimidation on a society. And when it goes greater to that level, it starts doing, you know, radical things to the point we see what happened in France, for example. These people were trying to say, don't mess with us, civil war coming on our way, because this is our way of life. And if you don't, you know, respect us, then we will make you, you know, or you lose your nation. We are coming to this here, the whole world, we are coming to this. So Sharia law, it is the principle of Sharia law is to subjugate the nations, even indirectly, to Islamic laws, like freedom of speech, liberty, freedom of expression, freedom of media, freedom of constitution. All these will have to submit to Sharia law because they could not exist. Why? Because they are man-made constitution, while Sharia is the constitution of Allah and Muhammad to the Muslim. And so therefore, they must subjugate everybody, even to the point enslave them to that understanding by either, you know, make them their slave or even commit death in their life.
General, there's so many people in our country that think it could never happen here.
Yeah.
They don't even understand how much we're being influenced. But when you start to explain it to them, their eyes will open up. I'd like you to pick some of the examples of how Sharia or the goal of achieving Sharia here in America is taking place.
John, this is a constitution. I served this constitution for, you know, 36 and a half years. Article 6 says this constitution shall be the supreme law of the land, which means there can be no foreign law. I worked with the Center for Security Policy in 2011. We did a study. We studied 50 court cases in 23 states around the nation and found that judges admitted that they administered justice using Sharia as the foundation for that. That's illegal. It's a violation of this Constitution. Don't say it can't happen here. It is happening here. Judges are using it. The most egregious case was the Muslim woman in the state court of New Jersey, the family court, who wanted a restraining order to stop her Muslim husband from beating and raping her. And the judge in that court said, no restraining order because your husband is a Muslim. He's allowed to beat and rape you. She won it on appeal. But that's just an example. It is in America. Now, the other thing you need to realize is that there are Muslim front groups, Muslim Brotherhood front groups in America. It was proven in 2008 in the Holy Land Foundation trial when Muslim groups all over America were identified as unindicted co-conspirators. When five defendants were convicted on 108 counts of raising funds in America to support Hamas, a recognized terrorist organization. And all these front groups, there was close to 300 of them, starting with the Council of American Islamic Relations, were identified as front groups for the Muslim Brotherhood. They still operate with impunity in America today. They are prolific in every element of our society. And what's really interesting is the leading Muslim advocacy group, the Council of American Islamic Relations, CARE, was identified about 2 months ago by the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia as being a terrorist organization. Now, the question that we all be asking as Americans, has our government declared them to be terrorist organizations when their own kind are recognizing them as a terrorist organization? The answer is, we have not. We have a problem here.
Follow up on that thing that you're talking about. The states have recognized that some of these judges are using Sharia to adjudicate their cases, and they have tried to pass laws to stop that. Tell our folks what happened when they've done that.
Well, Oklahoma was the first state to actually pass this law. It's called American Laws for American Courts. And the Eric Holder Justice Department immediately challenged it as being unconstitutional. Other states began to modify it, and now I think there are 9 states that have actually passed it. The one that everybody was hoping would pass it this year was Texas, but Texas has gone the other way. Texas has now, up in north central Texas there, they actually have an enclave up there where there is overwhelming evidence that they are now allowing imams to administer justice. But these state legislatures, and I would say to your audience here, if there's anybody that has influence over this, get your state legislatures to start working on this American Laws for American Courts. The camel's nose is already under the tent. And don't say it can't happen in America. It is happening in America as we sit here today.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to ask the fellows to talk about what happens to women if we adopt Sharia law. Okay? If you are a woman and you're watching, I think you'll be interested in this next segment. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. All right, we're back. We're talking with General Boykin. We're talking with Kamal Saleem. We're talking with Dr. Emir Kaner. And right now I want to approach this topic that we hear country after country embracing Sharia and becoming the law of their land. We've talked a little bit about what it is, but what happens to women in a society that embraces Sharia? If we were to embrace Sharia here in America, like some are advocating, then all of you that are ladies out there, what happens? What are the rules to the road that you would be living under? All right? And Dr. Kaner, I'd like you to talk about this first.
Well, crucial to the discussion, I think, is from the Quran, Surah 434. Any woman should read it. It is To a Christian, we say Ephesians 5 is one of the marriage chapters. To the Muslim, it's chapter 4 of the Quran. If a man fears disloyalty from one of his wives, he's allowed up to 4, according to chapter 4 and verse 3. He has 3 progressive steps to take care of her. He verbally admonishes her. It's a disciplinary action. If she doesn't listen, then he does not share his bed with her. And so he removes himself from intimacy, which is, of course, poor counsel, but that's what it says. And then 3, it says, beat her. And there's no other way to translate it from the Arabic, although in the English translation, it will put in parentheses lightly. And then there'll even be in Sharia how to beat a woman without breaking bones and bruising and so forth. That's one of the crucial verses. In fact, it's so bad that in one of the hadiths, Aisha, Muhammad's wife, comes to Muhammad with a woman. She's wearing green clothing. And it says when she unravels her clothes, she is as green in her skin as her clothing because of her husband beating her. But in Islam, women are not allowed to leave their husbands unless they have spiritual infidelity, they leave the faith, they're proven insane, or they have committed adultery of some sort. So the woman tries to say, my husband can't have children, because she has no other ability to say just because of beating. That's a right in Islam to beat her. And Muhammad finds out that she has children, her husband is not impotent, and so has no right to divorce. So Muhammad says, you go back and sleep with him again. There's a picture of how women will be treated if they follow the words of Muhammad, who at that point is not a prophet, he's a psychologist. He's dealing with marital counseling. He's dealing with his own, in the hadith, that Muhammad's talking about women having half the intelligence of a man in Bukhari's hadith, volume 3, number 826. This is just a small portion of what we would deal with, where women are a field to be plowed, chapter 2 of the Quran says.
What about inheritance?
Well, the inheritance, you know, Muslims love to brag that the rights were given to women after Islam came in. But it's not true that there is an equality of inheritance. And they have to realize this not only with inheritance, by the way, but with children. If a woman divorces, the husband has full right over the children when the boy is 7 and when the girl is 9. So there really is no control of the family besides what the husband controls. It's true of inheritance. It's included with children. That's the issue of Islam. It is completely antithetical to how the West lays its foundations for freedom and for equality of women.
Kamal, what would you add to that?
Well, it goes deeper than this. Muhammad says, I looked upon hell and I found the fuel of hell is made out of women. You know, and then he said, you know, a woman also in Sahih al-Bukhari, he said, she's half brain of a man. She never have the same understanding as she had her menstrual, experience. So Allah made her to have half brain of man. So therefore, she's not equal to the man. In Islam, the woman is second citizen. She's not first citizen. In Islam, a woman must be owned by her father, by her husband, by her uncle, by her brother, by her son, but she must be owned. Also in Islam, when a man marry a woman, he is purchasing her sexual organs, so she become his to own, to have. In Islam, also in the Quran, it says, if she allows you further, you know, to oppress you further, you have the right to kill. You know, so therefore what happened is we find out that even, you know, this is called honor killing. Honor killing came to the United States of America, and many of these men, after they killed these women, they said, we've done nothing wrong.
What is honor killing?
Honor killing is when a woman dishonor you, so you have to spill her blood to wash the dishonor.
How can they dishonor you?
Dishonor you, whether she looked upon, like for example, we look at the two sisters, that their father was an Egyptian taxi driver in Texas. You know, they went out on a date to the movie theater on New Year's Eve. He asked them to the hotel, and after they came to the hotel, he shot them in the head with a pistol. One called 911 as she's dying. Another one in Seattle, what happened? He ran over his daughter with his Jeep Cherokee 8 times because she want to go with marry an American man. And the story goes further, more and more. So therefore, a woman is only second citizen, but the non-Muslim, the infidel, are not even citizen. They don't come to be a citizen because you are not equal to Islam. So therefore, you lose your authority in all this. And now as a woman, The Muslim have the rights, if you are not a Muslim woman, to have sexual, like raping is okay. We see in Europe today there are thousands of rapes, happening throughout Europe because they are permitted to do such a thing because she is not a Muslim. The same we see with ISIS. If she is not my flavor of Islam, I have the right to do anything to her. Women can be bought, she could be sold, a man can marry four women, and he can divorce anyone, she could not divorce him. And what happened is, she is his slave to have.
Emir, what does it take for a man to divorce a woman? What does she have to do?
For the man, he just declares three times, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you. There is a waiting period to find out if she is pregnant or not, and that's it. Remember, in Islam, for a man, not for a woman, he has more rights than her. So, for example, he is allowed to marry a monotheist as long as that monotheist converts to Islam and raises the children as Muslim. He has a right to have four wives. She's, of course, not allowed. He has a right to divorce for any reason, irreconcilable differences. So he has complete control over her, which, as Kamal pointed out, really is a property right of sorts. And that's why you're watching what happens to women in Afghanistan and Iraq and so forth. And when the Saudis themselves look at women, they have modesty police, religious police, who guard the women's modesty and their apparel. And even if they're wearing Muslim garb, but it's too tight, they get beaten with a stick till they get new garb to put on. It is from the smallest to the largest extent that women are completely controlled by the men of their lives, whether first their fathers or their older brothers and then their husbands.
Emir, what happens if a Muslim woman is listening today and were to hear about Jesus Christ and she would say, I want to put my faith in him because I believe he is the Son of God. He came and he paid for my sins. He is the way that I get to heaven. I want to put my faith in him. Could she do that?
Well, and I've had that happen. I've had the privilege of leading Muslim women to Christ from North Africa and former Soviet republics and so forth. It's a sad thing to watch, the fear of having to tell their father because they know he's the one that's responsible for their souls and all sorts of things. If you're in places of North Africa, you go to re-education camps until you're taken and brought back to Islam. If you won't listen from there, you'll be put to death. Many times it'll be the father or the older brother who's the one to pick up the stone and to kill that woman for shame in the family, dishonoring, treason against Allah. In chapter 3 and verse 85 of the Quran, it says, if you accept another religion, it'll never be accepted of you. Muhammad makes it more stark of a contrast when he says, if a Muslim changes his Islamic religion, kill him. And so you have the stark picture of what would happen to anyone who leaves Islam for any reason, whether they become a Christian or a Jew or a Buddhist. They are to be put to death. They are to be annihilated because they have shamed Allah. They have mocked the Prophet Muhammad. They've committed treason, is what the Quran says. And ultimately, they deserve the lowest levels of hell.
All right. Question to you and then to Kamal. When you became a Christian as a teenager, you told your dad what happened.
Yeah, when I was in middle school, I became a Christian. I got saved and Jesus saved me and told my father, and he just said, you'll choose this day between that new religion of yours and me. It was more merciful than what would happen in Pakistan or Saudi Arabia or a myriad of countries. But it was more merciful, I believe, because of where I was living, because of the armed forces and their protection of my freedoms. I can speak on the show today. I was able to tell my father, I was at least able to share Jesus with him once. And while I lost him as a father, the beautiful picture of Scripture is, I will never leave you nor forsake you. Mm-hmm. Jesus promised, even the Great Commission, I'll be with you always, even to the end of the age.
And after he disowned you, then how long was it before you saw him again when he came to die?
Yeah, I was disowned for a total of 14 years. A couple days before his death, he said he wanted to see us, which was a remarkable time in my life. I went up to his home in Ohio, got to see him. He handed me a Quran. Asked me to revert back to Islam. Of course, I would not. I was there just to share Jesus with him. I wanted to love my father in the greatest way I could, which would be to share the love of Christ. He wouldn't let a Bible in his home, wouldn't let Jesus be mentioned. He dies 4 days later. He wanted me up there, not merely reconciliation, which was an incredible time. He wanted his son to go back to Islam.
Kamal, you have a different story. you were part of the Muslim Brotherhood. You came to infiltrate our country, and God wonderfully changed your life and brought you to Christ. But as a result of that, what do you live under?
Well, there's a big price to pay, you know, if you look at the worldly aspect of it. Number one, I have fatwas on my head from my family. My family want me dead. Different families as well. And then the Muslim Brotherhood and many others. That's why when they could not kill you physically and you live in a sovereign nation like United States of America, protected by the Constitution, they could not kill you. So they will go after your character assassination to destroy your character, that you are not no longer real. So therefore they can, you know, stop you from living and being who you are. My family, I did not see my father when he died. One of my family members called me and they said, they're waiting for you at the airport. If you cross over, you'll be dead. Do not come in. I lost my inheritance. I lost my everything, my heritage. I lost everything. But today I look at something greater. You know, my father in heaven, he is my father who adopted me as a son today. And I have a true father who cares for me. When my father, worldly father, let me go, the Muslim Brotherhood adopted me, and I became a son of radicals, you know, and so therefore I was committing my life to death from its infancy, and I lived by that code. But today, it is the freedom that I live in Christ Jesus, because he gave his life for my sake, that I may be a true son grafted into the promise that even God gave to all the Muslim people in Abraham, and so therefore Jesus became the way and the life and truth. And he's saying to the Muslim, come through me and I will give you that promise that I gave to your forefather.
General, as you've listened to these two, there was a time when you put your faith in Christ, but you didn't face the circumstances these guys did. What would you say to the audience who's listening right now and they're hearing people say, listen, what we need to do is implement Sharia here in America? What's your final word?
The final word is you don't know what you're asking for. You don't understand what Sharia is about. You don't understand the consequences of Sharia. You don't understand that it cannot be in a coexistence with our Constitution. We need to be fighting Sharia. We need to stand up against it. We need to have our state legislatures, and we need ultimately to have our federal government, our Congress, to take a stand against Sharia. That can only happen, though, if Christians, people of faith, get involved in the political process, vote, support candidates. But Sharia cannot coexist with our Constitution, and that is an absolute. And for all of these women's groups and all of these gay and lesbian groups that are out there advocating for a peaceful coexistence, what they don't realize is they are the very first ones that are targeted. They are the first ones that lose their rights. In fact, in the case of the LGBT agenda, they are targeted for death. So they need to think about what this is. Get informed. This program is a good way to get informed. Share it with your neighbors. They need to understand what we're talking about here today.
Next week, we're going to continue this conversation, but we're going to talk about how the Muslim Brotherhood and all of the front organizations that it has brought with it into America, what is the progress that they are making? And we're going to talk about the spheres of influence that they have in our country already. And you will be absolutely shocked to find this out. So I hope that you'll join me next week.
For additional resources, log on to jashow.org. That's jashow.org.